Love Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand, walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I'm just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Well, good evening, wherever you may be. Welcome to Yada Yada Radio. It's wonderful to be with you on a Shabbat, and not just an ordinary Shabbat. This is a Shabbat that is part of Sukkah. And we'll turn to Sukkah in just a moment. We've got JB and Kirk here. Hello, fellas.
Good evening.
Good evening. I do want to share just a quick note because I was reading the news prior to the program. You know, the FBI has sent out a public declaration asking the public to help them find a motive for the Las Vegas shooting. Now, I'm going to tell you, if the FBI has been forthright, which is a big if, and if, in fact, there is no social media website, no Facebook site, no Twitter, no internet site where this fellow has presented his manifesto, his reasons behind what he is doing. And if he has no written letter, a parting letter, or manifesto in that regard that has been written out, nor any audio or video accounting of why he did this, then the answer is obvious. And it's stunning to me that people can't figure it out. The answer is there is no motive.
Yeah, crazy don't have motive.
No, there is no motive. There is a cause.
Yes.
And the cause is Valium. The cause is the psychiatrist that prescribed the Valium. The cause is a society that passed laws that prevent the disclosure of anything, any information regarding those who are being treated for mental disorders, including anxiety disorders. That is the cause. The tactic was guns. They're not the cause.
Mm-hmm.
There is no motive. There is a common denominator in all mass killings around the world. They're either perpetrated by fundamentalist Muslims who are motivated by Muhammad's demonic scriptures, or they are being prescribed and are going on and off psychiatric drugs. That's the common denominator in all of these things. One of those two things. One is a motive, the other is simply a cause. And our society has failed to deal with that underlying problem of, A, why are so many people being prescribed psychiatric drugs? What has happened to our society that people have to have their brains realigned with different chemicals?
In order to deal with it? What is that?
Yeah.
What
they can't cope.
What do you think?
Unless they have mood-elevating drugs, they have painkillers, they have anti-anxiety drugs. Why is it that so many Americans require mind-altering drugs? And why is it, as a society, we don't provide those who are not taking them with a means of protecting themselves from these individuals. Because A, mm-hmm. all of these mind-altering drugs serve as a depressant. They slow the cognizant abilities of the user. It's like being drunk.
Mm-hmm.
They slow their response time. They dull their mind. So they're dangerous driving cars. They ought never be sold a gun. And a byproduct of these drugs is aggression. And the drugs, while they may help a lot of people, if taken properly, if the psychiatrists and psychologists are following up with the individuals, and that obviously didn't happen here because according to his girlfriend, he would lay in bed for hours and scream. What was your first clue, Sherlock, that maybe he was having a bad reaction? But when the user, who isn't, you know, the sharpest tool in the shed, starts manipulating their supply, takes too much, takes too little, goes on and off the drugs, the results are catastrophic. The chemical imbalances in their mind cause them to do things that they wouldn't otherwise do. And they want to go off of them because they feel terrible on them because their thinking is fuzzy. I don't know how many of you might watch the NCIS series. It's an NCIS New Orleans. And this last Tuesday's episode was about a woman who was prescribed these kind of psychiatric drugs. And she had gone off of them because she could not think clearly with them because they intoxicate, debilitate an individual's ability to think. And when she went off of them, she became violently aggressive.
Is that normal?
It's one of the most common side effects of psychiatric drugs, particularly Valium is a brand name. I can look up the name of the actual chemical. But Valium is the most popular brand name of the drug that Paddock took. So,
well, you know, think about it like this. This person has been diagnosed with a mental disorder, and so we're going to put them on the honor system that this medication, they're going to keep taking it. We're just going to take them at their word on it.
Absolutely.
How does that make any sense?
And we're not going to disclose to the rest of society. There's no indication on the car that they're driving that this person is dangerous. You better give them a lot of room. That this person you're following is capable of making erratic and violent moves, and their judgment is slowed. You ought to be very careful. Your safety is at risk. We don't, because of the HIPAA laws, do not allow anybody to disclose this, so these people can get jobs driving, flying airplanes. Doing things that put other people's lives at risk, and we don't disclose it. And there doesn't seem to be any follow-up system to prevent them from doing things that are dangerous because of the HIPAA laws. We put ourselves in this position. You know, and Jimmy Kimmel, you idiot out there, that's supposed to be America's conscience for crying about guns. Guns are not the problem. The problem are these mind-altering psychiatric drugs and the way they are prescribed and the lack of disclosure to the public at large about these individuals and their propensity to misuse them. Whether it's pain pills or it's mood-elevating pills or it's anti-anxiety pills, we're altering the chemical balance of the brain and we're putting the public at large at risk. This is the consequence. So, for anyone listening, all of these idiots that are looking for a motive, there is no motive. There is a cause.
Mm-hmm.
And the cause, unless we deal with the cause, you could get rid of, you could make buying guns illegal, and you aren't going to change anything.
No, they just hit you with a rock. Or knife.
Drive cars into you. Blow up pressure cookers and tear off legs and arms and mutilate.
You can make a lot of weapons using household items.
Absolutely. Or the idiot that poured acid on people and the Muslim that poured acid on people, the Muslim that drove his car into people, the Muslim that planted the bombs that blew off people's legs. The Muslims that blew up trains throughout Europe. There's lots of ways to kill.
When I was about 8 years old, my grandfather taught me how to make a small pipe bomb to blow up old tree stumps when we were clearing out his yard, using nothing but stuff we had laying around the house.
Correct. It is not hard.
Not hard if you know what to do.
Correct. This guy went ballistic, if you will, beginning in June, which is when he was prescribed these drugs. That is our national crisis, and no one wants to deal with it. It's twofold. Threefold. One is the drugs themselves are a problem in far too many cases. Second, the people are going on and off the drugs and misusing the drugs, which is creating an extraordinarily dangerous situation. And we're not disclosing the drug use, which we're putting people in harm's way. Those are the issues. And then the overriding issue that no one wants to address is what have we done to ourselves that has caused so many people to seek painkillers, anti-anxiety medication, and antidepressant medication just to cope with life? Why are so many people become addicted to drugs, particularly fentanyl and heroin and cocaine and to alcohol? Why are people incapable of dealing with reality and looking for an escape? Why are their lives so hopeless, so meaningless, so anguishing? Why do we have over 600,000 veterans that are claiming post-traumatic stress syndrome and are being medicated for it with psychiatric drugs? Why? And unless people want to deal with those questions, then the debate is on the wrong subject. We are celebrating Sukkah. Sukkah is a 7-day celebration plus 1 day. Any idea why it is 7 days and why there's the plus 1 day?
Well, 7 is the eternity.
And 8 is the eternity. 6 plus 1 equals 7, and there's 6 steps to Sukkah, with Sukkah being the 1 of 6 plus 1. So 7 is in summation of the path we walk to camp out with God. So that's absolutely true. What about the 8th?
Eternity.
All right.
Yeah.
And the Hebrew, the 8th letter in the Hebrew alphabet was originally drawn as an 8, which is the symbol of infinity. And so it does. It represents infinity. And the reason it's presented both ways is because Yahweh's plan for humankind played out over 6 plus 1 days. 6,000 years from the time that Adam and Chawa were booted out of the garden to the time that we returned to the garden, there's 6,000 years. 3,968 BCE is 6,000 years to 2033 on the Roman pagan calendar, when he will return and establish a 1,000-year celebration of Sukkah and the Shabbat. So those are 6,000 years plus the 1,000-year celebration of Sukkah and the Shabbat. That's the 7,000-year plan and timeline for humankind. But it doesn't all end then. Well, it will for all but a tiny fraction of humanity. For 1 in 1,000,000, it will not end there. Yahweh is going to destroy the earth as we know it and the universe as we know it, and going to allow us to witness a rebirth of a new universe. And we will be witnesses this time and be able to celebrate a whole eternity with him in that new universe. So the 8th day represents the eternal celebration of camping out with God in the new universe that he's going to create for our entertainment. Sukkah is a really interesting thing, and it's the simplest of all of the Mikra. And if you read about Sukkah in Bereshit Genesis, It is, you know, simply a place to camp out. If you read about it in Job, or read about it in Yonah, you read about it in the life of Dodd, it always represents camping out with God. It's really simple. That's what God wants to do. If you want to understand Sukkah, read the opening chapters of Bereshit, Genesis, and consider what life was like in the garden. Our one-on-one relationship with Yahweh. No religion, no government, no laws, just one-on-one, father-son, communication, and a celebration of life. That's what Sukkah is. That's what it represents going forward in eternity. That's Yahweh's intent, his purpose, that we all have a chance to camp out with him. And camping out is something he likes to do, and the campground for him is rather large. It's not limited to Jerusalem. It's not limited to Yisrael. It's not limited to the third planet from the sun in this solar system. It's not limited to the solar system. It's not limited to the Milky Way galaxy. It's not even limited to this entire universe. Yahweh's got a really big campground, and he wants to camp out with us for all eternity. That's what he's offering. And
what a guy.
Yeah, what a guy. And part of that means that in eternity, you know, for us to enjoy the universe, we have to be essentially light. We have to be transformed from material, corporal, to energy-based beings. But for us to camp out, to enjoy the warmth of a fire, to enjoy the food cooked around the fire, to sing songs around the fire, to dance and share stories around the fire, we have to be transformed, E equals MC squared, back into a maternal being, a material being, and we will be able to do that. We'll be able to move back into the ordinary flow of time and enjoy food and drink, enjoy one another's company and the warmth of a fire and the beautiful sparkle of the stars right on the same schedule all the way through eternity. We'll continue to celebrate these days, and then in between we can be transformed into light and go anywhere in the universe and be anywhere at any time and experience life and creation to our heart's content. Pretty marvelous idea.
Sign me up.
Sign me up. Yeah, I'm ready to go. Kirk, you had an occasion to search Yahweh's name and how it got removed and twisted and replaced. What was the impetus of that search, and what did you find?
Well, you know, it was really I was looking through. I was studying Hebrew grammar. And one of the examples that were used was Yahweh's name. And I started thinking about that based on a couple things that we had covered in the past and one recently. So I was trying to analyze what they were saying in terms of what I know. And
can I interrupt you for a moment just to get a
certain
insight here?
Sir.
By studying Hebrew grammar, from my perspective, Hebrew grammar is based upon the fact that verbs are written with stems, which establish a relationship between the subject and object. They're written with conjugations, which determine whether or not the action is ongoing and habitual and unfolding over time, or perfect, which means that it is for a limited time, either in the past, present, or future. That there are no tenses in terms of past, present, or future in Hebrew. Hebrew is just simply true. And that many verbs in Hebrew are ascribed a mood, most of which are volitional in nature and either ascribe first, second, or third person volition. And that the only other aspect of Hebrew grammar that I find, two others interesting, is there really is no punctuation, but the wa is used as a comma and as a period as the start of a new sentence. So the wa becomes the punctuation. And that ma and a number of other words are the interrogatory, so that you actually begin rather than end the question with the indication this is a question. So there are interrogatories for that matter. And that Hebrew is not always subject, verb, object, that the order can be different, and that Hebrew is like most languages, and that there are feminine and masculine nouns and gender neutral nouns, and that that pronouns and conjunctions and prepositions and the like are always ascribed to or become part of words, so that they are included in the word itself as opposed to separate words. That there are in the Hebrew language 5 vowels and 17 consonants. That's my, if I were to summarize Hebrew grammar as I know it, well, one last thing, and that is that like most languages, Hebrew is wagon red rather than red wagon. The modifiers follow either the verb or the noun. Yes.
Yeah.
So the modifiers, adjectives and adverbs, follow the verb and the noun as opposed to going before them.
Yeah. That's perfectly said. And what I did, I was going through these things, and I started thinking about a couple of verses or a couple of parts of the Torah where one of my favorite ones recently has been Yeshayahu 56, and his opening sentence says, and we're talking about Yahweh's name, his opening sentence says,
yeah.
Children who form a relationship with Yahweh, serving and loving Yahweh, Yahweh's personal and proper name. And then he goes on, and it always continues, but if if his name cannot be pronounced, if his name cannot be understood, or you don't
if
his display
name
it where you can't
with
think.
Adonai, the Lord, you
yeah.
lost it.
Right. So if you can't, how can you love a name that you don't know, you can't pronounce,
right.
you don't understand, because all names in Hebrew have a meaning. So if I say,
how can you not pronounce
right now,
Yahweh's name when you find Yahweh's name in Moshe's mouth all of the time, he's proclaiming his name. In Dode's mouth, who Yahweh dearly loves all of the time, and in Shamuel's mouth all of the time, they're constantly saying Yahweh's name, as is Yeshayah, as he recited Yahweh's testimony to the community. Okay. All of these people said his name.
Yeah.
Yahweh said his name, and he was communicating to Moshe. How could it not be pronounced?
God
created an alphabet where every word could be pronounced except his name.
Yeah, the absurdity is beyond my
absurdity. It's just remarkable. I mean, how stupid you'd have to be to think that the name is not pronounceable when it's comprised of 3 vowels, which are the easiest of all letters to pronounce. Yeah, and the most common.
What is it? Let me ask you a question. Call me stupid if I'm wrong, and I hold mine.
Yeah.
And I wrote a little note. I said, by the way,
I can be like Tillerson and call you a moron?
Yeah, absolutely. You can do whatever you want.
Okay.
I'll take it. I'll be a better man for it. By the way, how does Yeshayah even say that sentence without being able to pronounce Yahweh?
Well,
you say,
Yeshayah is 99% of Yeshayah's dictation. So.
Yeah.
How can Yahweh?
So how does he
communicate
it? How does he write it down? How does
he can't say his own name?
Yeah, Yahweh told me to tell you this, but I can't say Yahweh. So, in the second point I came to in this ludicrous story that the rabbinics have changed and Christians have gone along with it. Yahweh and Barashif, and you just mentioned it, Moshe questioned the first thing he says to Moshe is he says, I am, or Haya, I exist.
Yeah.
And you've got the 3 letters there, the Hey, Yah, Hey, Wah, and the Hey.
Right.
So we know we can pronounce all of those. And
with an asher, by the way, in between them. So Haya, Haya, I am, and then asher, which is the relational term that if you look at at Asher. It is a beneficial, something that brings a relationship benefit and shows the way to get the most out of life. It was what Asher means. So it's Ihaya. I exist, I was, I am, I will be. Asher, beneficially, to show the way to the relationship. Existing, was, is, and I am always existing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Ihaya, Asher, Ihaya, it says.
So you have to confirm.
How can you not pronounce his name when he tells you the verb that explains how to pronounce his name?
Well, he goes out of his way to make sure you can.
Right.
If you
three of the four letters and Yahweh's name are in Haya.
Yeah. But if you said, my name is Craig, if I'd only repeated it, I would just repeat it. I could do that. Moshe, if that's all Moshe
right.
got, you could
yeah.
do that.
And what did Yahweh tell Moshe right after saying, I am Hoot beneficially to show the way to the relationship I am? Didn't the next words out of his mouth?
The next
word of people that my name that is my name for all time.
Yahweh,
the only way I want to be remembered and recalled.
Yeah, for all time.
I love how people all ignore that part. They'll quote the first part and then completely ignore the second part of the sentence.
Correct. Yeah. And it happens all the time. And if somebody writes that and you just say, oh my God, how can you be that stupid? Obviously, you're not that stupid, so why are you being deceptive? Why did you leave it out?
I think most Christians don't know. They don't read it.
How many sermons have been done on what was the thorn in Paul's side?
Yeah.
And he tells you the thorn in his side at the end of the sentence, which is a demon possessed. Duh. And then once you figure out, I'm demon possessed, maybe you want to throw away that letter.
Yeah, you're probably, he's not the authority.
Maybe this isn't the guy I want to pin my hat on.
No, I don't think that I want inspiration from Satan. No, thank you.
Well, let me throw some more at you. I'm combining a couple of lexicons.
Sure.
But I'll read a little bit, then y'all throw your two cents in, because this is very odd to me when I was studying. It says, first of all, one of them says the transliteration and the translation comes out to Yahweh.
Vihei. I didn't know there was V in Hebrew.
Yeah. What happened to the Wah and
can you also explain to me, I'm just curious here, why is the hey pronounced ah in the first syllable and m in the last? Did the letter change? Are there two different hays, and I'm just not familiar with the second one?
Yeah, so it gets worse. They go on to the, instead of saying etymology, they go on to the morphology that's actually described as morphology. One of them does anyway, and it's in the end of the Yahweh. And of course, it cites Strong's 3680.
Wait, something's really interesting. Well, just as a thought here. The Wah isn't the in modern Hebrew, as they've tried to adapt the Hebrew alphabet to particularly the English, and there's a V in English. So in modern Hebrew, what they have done is the B is the optional letter. The B is sometimes construed to be the B sound, like Rabbi Akiva or Rabbi Akiva. And so you'll find it both ways. So it's usually the B, the Beth, that is becomes the letter that creates the B sound, because the Wah, and 100% of Hebrew words where there is a Wah, it either makes the O or U, double O or U sound. And 100% of Hebrew words where you find the
Wah. What is the single most well-known Hebrew word in the world? Jew in the world today greet each other?
Shalom.
Shalom. They don't say shalom.
Right. Where is the O sound in shalom? It comes from the Hebrew wah. What's the second most commonly repeated Hebrew word?
Torah.
Torah, of course. Yeah,
Torah. And Torah, the O sound in Torah comes from the Hebrew wah. It's not hard, folks.
No, this.
Most people know Elohim as the plural of El, but. L is a contraction of Eloah. And Elohim is the plural of Eloah. Guess where the O sound comes from in Eloah? Yeah, Job. Where do you think the O sound comes from in Job?
Same one. It's always the Job. Yeah, that's the letter.
That's the law. How about Yonah? Yeah, how about Yonah?
That's the same. On and on.
Shabuah?
Yeah. You're right.
Not Shabuah.
Right. All the same. It's so obvious if you just open your mind and you take the time. All right. So what else do you find?
Well, this is how they try to justify it. So they say, and the name came from Hey-Wah-Hey, which prefixes with prefix of the Yod, identifying the subject of the verb as a third person masculine singular. So far, that's fine. Therefore, it means that he exists. Which is
it? Actually, it's not third person. It's Ihaya. It's first person.
That's why the Y begins and
indicates that it's first person masculine singular. And Haya is the verb. So, Ihaya, I am, pronouns, we talked about that, they're always attached to the verb. So, Ihaya would be I am, first person, masculine, singular. I was, I am, I will be.
So, they blew it again. Then they further in the commentary, in one of them, I found the explanation for the vowel pointing attached to this word never meant for the pronunciation of his name. Instead, this one we talked about earlier, they are the vowel pointing for the word Adonai.
Correct.
Which is the word that Jews, and then it goes on to say, which is the word that Jews speak when they see the name Yahweh, or Yahweh, the original, and then it goes on to say the original.
But Adonai is, first of all, Adonai is not in the text. No, it was... In fact, even in the Masoretic text, so there's 132 times where the Masoretes replaced Yahweh's name with Adonai. Adonai is my Lord. They actually wrote Adonai above Yahweh's name. So Yahweh's name is there. 4 times, something like that, in the Masoretic text, and there's 132 times approximately that they just replaced it. So 7,000 times in total. But the vowel pointing on Adonai has no bearing whatsoever on Yahweh.
But isn't that interesting that they're trying to say as strong?
And it's a title, it's not a name. Yeah, Adonai is a title. It's Adon. Edon, properly vocalized. Edon, when it's used in the Torah, it is Edon, and Edon is the upright pillar of the tabernacle that enlarges it, makes it secure. So it means by upright one, the upright pillar of the tabernacle. And Edon, which does mean Lord, is never applied to Yahweh. So, and it's not a name, it's a title. So, to use the vowel pointing, and by the way, Adonai and Edon don't require vowel pointing. Why? Because
you have vowels or
the vowels are supplied.
There are vowels. Yeah.
Right. By the way, the O sound from Edon comes from the wall.
So they go into, the original pronunciation of this name is unknown. What a crock. I mean, what a twist. And when Yah said, I hate people who don't diminish my name. Let's go back to the statements in Psalms on the first tablet. And he says, don't twist my name. He says, don't do this. And then they write this, and then they have to justify it in order to sell you the lexicon.
The most amazing part of that at all is that the third statement is etched in stone. The third statement and the final statement on the first of the two tablets. It's that Yahweh is saying that that He will not forgive. anyone who causes his name to be for naught. So it's an unforgivable sin to cause his name to be for naught. Shav is the word for to cause it to be negated, to be diminished in value, to be corrupted so that it no longer has the force of its purpose. So by replacing it with my Lord, that is the extreme example of what Yahweh said is an unforgivable sin. So every Bible translator and every pastor that reads my Lord as opposed to, or the Lord said as opposed to Yahweh, is in violation of the third statement, which is unforgivable. But beyond that,
Christian interpretation and translation of it is in itself a violation. Yeah, the Christian translation is don't take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, and they take that to mean don't say God damn. Both of those are in direct violation of exactly what you're saying not to do.
God will separate.
Right. Do not negate Yahweh, my name, because I will not forgive anyone who belittles, negates, demeans my name. And what's interesting is that the verb there, there's two verbs, nasa, to accept, lift up, to promote, that sort of thing. And shav is the negative, that is to negate, to corrupt, to twist, to belittle, besmirch, devalue. And it's in all the Hebrew lexicons is shav, but there is no B in Hebrew. And it's the actual verb is shoah. But the rabbis created their diacritical markings, the Masoretic system. The basis of it was originally conceived post-Babylonian exile, when the Jews hated being called Yahoos, like the website Yahoo. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yahoo was the demeaning slang for Yahudem. And so they were called Yahoos from Yahuda as a slang of it. And, of course, that means those who are related to Yah. So individuals who are related to Yah is Yahudem and Yahuda. They hated that, so they came up with a scheme to hide and alter the pronunciation of the wah and the hey. And so they called that scheme of deliberately hiding the pronunciation of the wah and the hey in Yahweh's name, the Shava system.
Shoah.
Yeah, which is the verb is actually Shoah, but they corrupted it to Shava. So they used the verb, yes, to corrupt, to twist, to belittle, and as the actual name of the system that they used to disguise and devalue Yahweh's name. Now,
and
that's in your face as Satan having Paul tell you that I'm demon possessed.
And nobody
blesses in your face is Allah naming that which is good in the Quran halal, when halal is Satan's first name.
Halal food, yeah, how good it is.
Yeah.
Right? Sure.
I mean, that's in your face.
Mm-hmm. So, I'll wrap it up with something I said earlier to you today. Is the German theologian lexicon, and it says Yahweh's name means he is eternal, never-ending, reliable, trustworthy, and so forth. And I said, well, if that's true, and he says, this is forever. This is my Moed Mikra. This is what I want you to do. Meet seven times a year with me in a joyous celebration. Shog. If that's so, then what I do with the New Testament other than throw it away and burn it?
Yes, yeah, can't be one.
Give me a break.
It can't be a new and different testament. It's impossible.
No.
Not based upon what Yahweh said. In fact, at the conclusion of his presentation of the seventh of seven Moed Mikra, this is what Yahweh conveyed, and this is Kara, called out Leviticus 23:37. These godly and specific, that's Eleh, from L and A. So these godly and specific appointed and designated meeting times, moed. Now, that ought to be a clue, because he uses moed in the creation account to talk about the fourth day and the timing of what's going to occur on the fourth day, as the fourth day that Yosha fulfilled the first four mikra. These godly and specific appointed and designated meeting times, moed, assemblies set by the authority for a particular purpose as a sign and signal of Yod-Heh-Wah-Heh, of Yahweh, which relationally and beneficially to show the way, you are invited to attend, Kara. You are summoned to be called out to meet, to read, and to recite accordingly as a Kodesh, set apart. That means not part of the ordinary, set apart, special. Mikre, invitations to be called out, assemblies to meet and encounter one another, reading and reciting, for the purpose of coming near and approaching Karab, answering the summons and presenting oneself before the Ishe, adoptive mother who enlightens and elevates as the feminine of fire. Yahweh's maternal light. Unto, oh, there's that name again, Yahweh. So these dates are celebrations that are designated by Yahweh. They're his dates. They have nothing to, they're not Jewish holidays. They're Yahweh's dates, and they're Yahweh's gift, mincha, a present, something offered without compensation, which elevate, olah, raises by way of that which is acceptable, a reconciling substitute, and also as a pouring out, nekak, of the word, a day for his day. Marvelous. What part of that do you want to replace with Christmas and Easter and Lent?
Zero.
And Halloween and New Year's Day and the 4th of July and Memorial Day and Labor Day? By the way, I just finished translating the first two-thirds of Yeshaya 8. And when Yahweh is at the very beginning of Yeshaya 8, Yahweh is talking to Yeshaya. And he says, what I want you to do is I want you to get a great big scroll. That was really interesting. There's only one scroll that we have that's a great big scroll. It's called the Great Isaiah Scroll. And I want you to get a really great big scroll. And then I'd like you to write this down using, and then he says, Enosh. You know what Enosh is?
Mortal humankind.
That's right. So the letters he's asking him to write, the alphabet he's asking him to write, is Enosh. Now, that's profound. What is the only letter repeated twice in Yahweh's name?
The A.
What does it depict?
A man standing up and reaching up. A woman standing up and gazing.
Enosh. Humanity.
Mm-hmm.
There are, I think, like 12 of the 22 letters that are human body parts. And all the others are things that man interacts with in his daily life. The entire alphabet was conceived and designed around humankind. And so the alphabet he asked him to use is the one that we're using. The one drawn to convey human attributes. Man standing up and reaching up to him. Man's mouth, man's teeth, man's hand, an open and outstretched arm and hand, a foot, an eye, sperm even. And then the things that affect a man, like the ultimate form of shepherding would be of sheep, and of a floor plan of a home, and of the first light of the day as you look over the horizon, a fence that protects the family, a shepherd's staff as a form of guidance and protection. So 12 letters that are actually humans, including one that's a person standing up and reaching up to God. They, the hay is the full McGillicuddy, the whole thing. Yeah. But then, so I just thought that his depiction of the alphabet, you know, he didn't use, I want you to write in Paleo-Hebrew letters. No, he said, the letters I want you to use are Enosh. Mortal man letters. That's the alphabet that you as an artist, Kirk, study.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Staring at him right now.
That's right. And the alphabet for Yahweh is just so profound. It's, upper arm coming down, a forearm reaching out with an open hand. That's the first letter in Yahweh's name. That's the Yod. Yod is actually the Hebrew word for hand. The second and fourth letter is a person standing up, reaching up. When it's the last letter in a word, it makes the word feminine. So the final person standing up, reaching up to God is feminine, therefore, in all likelihood, represents Sarah as the mother of the covenant. And the first person is Abraham as the father of the covenant. So it's two people standing up, reaching up to God. And in between them is the tent peg. Now, you know what's interesting about the tent peg? I've just never thought about this before. You ever think about the way the tent peg is described? Kirk, you ought to be able to, excuse me, JB, you ought to be able to figure this out. You sent me an email on it. I know that you said that the hay is drawn exactly as your daughter appeared as you and your wife were walking her in the park as she reached up. So that the hay is exactly as a parent would see their child. So it depicts how Yahweh sees us as a child reaches up to their parent's hand when a mom and dad is on the left and right side of the child and walks them in a public place to keep them safe. But the tent peg, think of the tent peg for a moment.
It's what the child would see.
Absolutely. It is the perspective of the child looking up to see their parents. The tent peg is really two arms reaching up and the kind of two legs right together coming down. It is the tent peg between the two hays depicts mother, father, and child.
Yeah. Tara and I really like that insight, JV. I know she said so, but that was pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah, but look at it now.
But I didn't
look
at it now.
I wrote it into a chapter, JV, is absolutely right, that a child appears to us as parents or as grandparents as the hay when in a public place and you're walking them because you're trying to guide them, you're trying to protect them, you're trying to lead them. It's exactly how a child appears when they're reaching up to their parents. But now look at Yahweh in Paleo-Hebrew, and look at the last three letters. The two people standing up, reaching up, and the tent peg between them. The tent peg between them is drawn just like a child between a mother and father.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the hand, God's hand reaching down to his covenant family. That's the picture.
And nobody wants to use those letters. They want to keep changing the blocky stuff.
No.
Oh.
No, I'm...
Wait, if they don't change even the smallest letter?
Yeah. You know what's interesting, too, is the hay. You know what hay and henna, the primary word based upon hay, mean in Hebrew?
Look and behold.
Pay attention, yeah, behold, pay attention. Pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
Be observant, if you will.
No, notice this. I'm revealing
something.
Yeah,
so what you have is an observant mother and father reaching up to God's hand with their child between them. It's the covenant family. And God reaching down and out with an open hand to lift up his covenant family. That's what the name represents. And there are four letters, two of which are repeated. And 99% of the time that a hey is presented in Hebrew, it is pronounced as it is in Torah, as it is in Haya, the word that he says defines his name. That's an ah sound. It's a vowel. Mm-hmm. And the wa, 100% of the time, is either pronounced O or U. And it's W. just like it is in English. I mean, you could just think of the number of words in English, hundreds of them, where the O precedes the W. O, oath, own, owl.
Oh, now brown cow.
Absolutely, cow. Absolutely, how. I mean, now. All of them. Not by accident. That is a legacy of Hebrew. It was the first alphabet and the first spoken language of man. So it is obvious. It's 20% of the time that there is a possibility, seems to be a legacy of it being an ooh sound. I'm not sure that is actually correct. You know, I think that like Yahuda, it is probably Yahuda. But I can't prove it. So
I wouldn't fight that battle, but I think you're right.
I'm not going to fight the battle, but it's probably Yahuda, not Yahuda. But we have names of about 30 or 40 people that are just where you have the Yah-O, and it's shortened to the just O sound, as in Yoba, Job.
Mm-hmm.
Jonah, as in Jonah, Joel, Yoel. We have so many of those that make it obvious that the Wah in Hebrew is the O sound. 80% of the time it appears as the O, 20% of the time it's the U, and I think you could probably dispute even those 20%. But there is no disputing the O, Torah, Shalom. Eloah, and so many other words. Or for light. So there we go. Anything else you found as they tried to justify it?
No, I didn't go that deep beyond that. Because, you know, it's like after you get through the first five pages of questioning Paul, you throw him away. So I mean, it's pretty...
Right.
But I'll approach it again because it's a fun thing to do. But, wow, I just thought...
Yeah,
you guys are nuts. Why would you do?
Yeah, we had a pastor that wrote us this week. I just sent him his email back, saying that his daughter had become a member of the covenant, and I encouraged him to read these books. And his big issue right now was, I thought I was saved. Now, how do I get to be saved? He says, I can tell you that. You know, I went from being a pastor to being essentially excommunicated because I began to question how in the world you could reconcile Paul with what God had to say, even what he would say the Messiah had to say. And when he said he brought those questions up to others, elders, other pastors within the church, they all called him a heretic. Obviously can't deal with that. They don't want to deal with it, so they want to shoot the messenger when somebody brings them those questions. He said, I thought I was saved, but, now I don't know. What do I got to do? My reply.
Well, Nicodemus, you go back to the Torah, don't you?
Yeah, I kept on saying, same thing right to everybody that says, how do I know how do I get to be saved? And he is saying, Christians are fixated on salvation, and yet not a single Christian throughout time has ever been saved. Not one. And yet they're fixated on salvation. And I said, when you think about it, that's a really, really selfish and irrational approach. Shouldn't you first come to know who Yahweh is? Decide if you like him or not? I mean, being saved and therefore spending eternity with him is a very long time. Don't you first want to figure out if you like him?
Yeah, you want to be saved to this.
Right. What do you want to be saved to? Then why don't you next find out what is it that he is asking of us and... what is he offering in return? Do you want what he's offering? And are you willing to accept what he's asking? And until you know who he is and decide that you like him and that you're willing to accept what he is asking because you want what he is offering, then respond.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they just want to be saved from that because in their minds it's heaven or hell and they just don't want hell. They don't care what heaven is. They don't want hell.
Yeah, of course, we got. So long as he's no longer a pastor, he doesn't have to worry about hell anymore.
Yeah.
That's been removed from the equation. And it's actually Sheol, named after the founder of the Christian religion. Saul.
Put
that in your head and smoke it. Yeah. The actual name of the place Christians call hell is Sheol, and it's written identically in the in Hebrew to Shaul, which is the name of the founder of the Christian religion and author of half of its New Testament. I will tell you for certain, since there's only two people named Shaul that are noteworthy in human history, and both of them were scumbags, that there is nobody named Shaul that is favored by Yahweh. That's like being Pope Damascus. There are neutral names. My name is neutral. Kirk, your name is neutral. They're not Hebrew names. They're not the names of phony gods or anything else. James, yours is a corruption of a Hebrew name.
Yeah, of a great Hebrew name. Yeah.
Right, it's Jacob. That's a great Hebrew name, yeah. Because Jacob is equivalent to Yisrael, and Yahweh constantly associates himself with Jacob. So Jacob is a really good name. And Kirk, your and my names are meaningless in the overall. But Shaul. Oh, that's a really, really, really bad name. That's exactly being named Hell. Now, if he had actually named himself Hell, and Christians understood that Hell is Sheol, that would have been a learning experience for them.
Well, he could call himself a plague of death.
That's what Yahweh called it.
And
it's just so funny, though. In his first letter, the first passage that he twists, he wants to say that the Torah can't save. So he quotes from Habakkuk, the second chapter. That's the passage that he cites to twist to claim that the Torah cannot save. And Habakkuk 2 was written exactly 666 years before Paul penned that very same letter. And it says that Shaul is the plague of death.
Yes.
And make certain that you don't mistake it for the place, because the place does not have a soul, and it is presented as the soul of Shaul is the plague of death.
Now, you cannot translate it that way. No.
Come on, folks. Wake up. I called him out by name. 600. You want to know who the 666 represents?
No.
It's Shaul. It's the Antichrist is Paul.
Yeah.
Now, will there be another manifestation of Paul? Yeah, absolutely. You know, the same demon that possessed Shaul, Paul, possessed Nero, likely Muhammad, likely Adolf Hitler, and will be exactly the same demon that will possess the Torahless one known to Christians as the Antichrist. But if you want a personality type, it's Paul. He'll be a homosexual, just like Paul was a homosexual. He'll be a Christian, just like Paul was a Christian. He'll be ruthless and violent, just like Paul was ruthless and violent. He will contradict himself. He will establish Sunday over the Shabbat. He will establish Christian holidays over the Yahweh's times. He will negate the entire 10 statements that Yahweh etched in stone. But his style, his persona, his character, his attributes, everything about him, his personality will be an absolute reflection of Paul. So if you want to know what the guy's like, read Paul's letters.
Read Paul.
See him there. Paul is the prototype. The founder of Christianity is the prototype for the Antichrist. Perfect. Same demon. And it is obvious. And if you want to challenge that, go ahead. Find a fault in questioning Paul. 1,200 pages of it. You refute that. If you're a Christian, go ahead. I dare you. Can't be done.
Nobody's come up. Nobody's up to the challenge.
No, I know it's been read by people around the world, and no one has read Questioning Paul from beginning to end and remained a Christian. It is absolutely impossible to do so. All right, let's return to we were in chapter 14 of observations. Chapter 9 in the observation show, we return back to the history of English Bible translations. I just want to have a quick review of that, Kirk, since we did it in the earlier show today. We reread and analyzed Jerome's letter. We call him erroneous because his name wasn't Jerome. To Pope Damascus as to why he needed to create this Latin translation. This Latin translation is the basis of the Christian Bible. And every English Bible is a translation of the Vulgate, and they are revisions of one another. It is the Christian Bible, and the letter that Jerome wrote to Pope Damascus as to why it needed to be done. We read again on the observation show, and if you are a rational and informed person and read that, or just listen to our analysis of it again today, you will throw away your Christian New Testament. You will recognize that the whole thing is a hoax. It was purposefully, connivingly created to establish a control mechanism for the Roman Catholic Church. And that's all that it is, and there isn't any part of it that's reliable. So if your faith is based upon the Christian New Testament, you need to know that your text isn't even remotely accurate, and it can't be resolved. The problems with it are irresolvable. Now, that is not true with the Hebrew text, and particularly with Yeshayah. We have the entirety of Yeshayah in the Great Isaiah Scroll dating to 200 BCE, and we have four additional partial scrolls of Yeshayah. Plus, we have the Masoretic text. And so, between those, we can be 99.9% accurate with Yeshayah, as we can be with most of the Torah prophet scrolls. Between the Masoretic text, which is errant, once you remove the diacritical markings and just look at the letters, once you ignore the fact that that there's been this move to replace Yahweh's name with Adonai, if you use the Dead Sea Scrolls to check the Masoretic text and you remove the diacritical markings of the Masoretic and look at the letters themselves and what they could convey based upon the letters themselves, with the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, you have the tools to be 99% accurate, maybe even higher than that. So it is not difficult. Yeah, not difficult. And even at the 99 percentile, Yahweh repeats himself so many different ways.
Uh-huh.
He tells the same story from so many different perspectives in so many different ways that it's impossible to miss the message. Now, for example, he's going to condemn religion again, and throughout Yeshayah opens up with, "I wanted a family. I wanted to raise you as my children, and you chose to be religious. You are," in fact, he actually uses the slam, "you are dumbasses. You're just dumbasses."
Slow folks from Alabama.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, even says, "You don't even know who your Lord is." Because their Lord is Satan. That's who their Lord is. You're a dumbass. I don't even know who their Lord is. Even a cow knows its mother. But you're dumbasses. You haven't got a clue who your Lord is. So he says, "Whoa." Oy is not a good term in Hebrew. When you hear "whoa," You ought to pay attention, because if the woe is directed at you, it's not good.
You're in deep stuff.
Yeah, woe. This is a warning. Alas, this disastrous and destructive situation can ruin a person. So this is a cautionary tale. To those who take the lead in promoting Mashach, those who draw up, carry out, and advance. So these are religious leaders now, because you'll hear the rest of this going forward. So God's disappointed in, but does not really know, all of the billions of people who have been fooled by religion. But he will judge all of those who have promoted religion.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're judged by God, it's over. If you're judged by God, you're going to spend time with Shaul and Sheol. And it's going to be a long, long, long period of time. To those who take the lead in promoting, who draw up, carry out, and advance, error, by twisting and distorting, that's the word that lies at the heart of your research project, Gerber.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
Awon. A-W-N. So, Awon. Awon is wrongdoing, wickedness through perversity, depravity, iniquity, sin. It alone means to warp the message, to pervert the message, to distort, to twist the message, is alone. Well, who twists the message? You know, politicians will sometimes twist the message of God, you know, bring God into their speeches, but they very, very, very seldom actually cite him. So they're just a passery look. God bless. But the religion of Christianity and the religion of Islam are both based upon a perversion of Yahweh's testimony. Their credibility is derived entirely from Yahweh's credibility, which then they bastardize and twist and pervert to serve their interests. So the religions of Christianity and Islam and Judaism, because the Talmud is a perversion of the Torah. The twisting and a perverting, a manner of perverting the and warping the message of the Torah. So the big three religions, Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, are defined by AWOL. And none of those three did they go out and say, you know, what I'm going to do is, I mean, they weren't like Scientology. Which, you know, L. Ron Hubbard says, okay, I'll take that bet. I can create a religion out of thin air. You know, and he has his dragon and his volcano and the souls, and he created a religion out of thin air, just on a bet.
He didn't usurp Yahweh's authority.
Right. You know, Joseph Smith, he was an idiot. And he didn't create Mormonism out of thin air. He just perverted it and twisted the Torah's message. That's all he did. That's what Islam is. The only parts of Islam that have any credibility is when he twists the Talmud, which are arguments on the Torah, to serve his interests. And Christianity is Paul twisting and perverting Yahweh's Torah and prophets to create a religion. So those religions are all based on AWOL. In a boisterous and agonizing religious parade, Bah Chabel, with the binding force of religion, with destructive and ruinous cords from Chabal, to bind and to pledge, to corrupt and to destroy. The closest word in Hebrew to religion is Chabel. So, woe, this is a warning to those who take the lead in promoting error by twisting and distorting in a boisterous and agonizing religious parade of error, futility, and vanity. This is the word that's repeated, the verb twice in the third statement of the Yahshua Stone. It's ha-shawa, of worthless lies, pagan gods, idolatrous images, false and empty promises. It's from show, to ravage, devastate, destroy, and ruin. Well, when you replace Yahweh's name with Adonai, my Lord, you've ravaged it, devastated it, destroyed it, and ruined it. Particularly since the Lord is Satan's name and title. Baal. That's a powerful opening statement. Woe, this is a warning to those who take the lead in promoting error by twisting and distorting in a boisterous and agonizing religious parade of error, futility, and vanity, of worthless lies, pagan gods, idolatrous images, false and empty promises, which ravage, devastate, and destroy. As with the ties that bind on the harness of a cart. This cart of sin, of chata'a, of punishable offenses and ceremonial sacrifices which lead the wrong way, from chata, to mislead, to miss the way, to incur guilt, to forfeit the opportunity by having gone the wrong way. The one among them says, without thinking and out of anxiety over the future, he should want to hurry. I want him to swoop down and accelerate his work so that we may see it. So then, let the vexing counsel and scheming plan of the Holy One of Israel approach and present itself, because we want to be made aware. No. Yeah, this is the Christian. You don't think the Christians are fixated on this. Take a stroll through a Christian bookstore. See how much of it is devoted to eschatology, to Bible prophecy.
That's the preponderance.
They you know why they want their God to come back? To kick some holy butt? They want their God to come back, their Jesus to come back, to A, prove they're right, and B, prove the people that doubted them, that criticized them, wrong. That's what they want. And so they're just like Paul when he wrote in his letter to Thessalonica, I think it was his second letter to Thessalonica, where he was really pissed at actually all of his letters. And he's pissed at the Galatians. He's pissed at the Ephesians. He's picked at the Thessalonians because they all rejected him. After he left, they all said, you know, that guy was really full of it. So he's really angry. And so what Paul writes is, yeah, he's going to come back. He's going to come back while I'm still here. And that's where he comes up with his rapture. And so he's going to come back. And those of us who are alive, we're going to be raptured after those who are dead are going to be raptured. Blink of an eye, but while he was still alive. He wanted him to hurry. Guess what? False prophet. He got that one wrong by a scant 2,000 years. Nice try, Paul. The fact is, yeah, I was going to...
He was in the ballpark.
Yeah, I mean, he wrote that in probably 57 to 60 CE, and he's going to return in 2033. Just shy of 2,000 years wrong. But that's the Christian mindset. They want him to hurry. Now, Shimon Kefesh, who was one of those who was called a disciple, that means a learner of Yosha, he took exactly the opposite approach, if you recall. When Yosha explained to him, you know, this is what's going to happen, he said, oh, well, let's not go there. I don't want you to hurry up and fulfill any of this stuff. let's put this on the brakes. Let's go the opposite direction. Yeah, Shimon Kefesh wasn't looking for proof. Paul wanted validation.
Knew.
Yeah. Yeah, he knew. So here's the just really an interesting review here. And I just want to share this. Who knows how much of this is true. You know, imagine, you know, it's the closest we have to being accurate of anything that is in the Christian New Testament. And kind of the interesting thing about Matanya was originally written in Hebrew, and the entire book is anti-Christian. So, you know, it was the book they least fussed with because they didn't want to read it, because it just, from beginning to end, it destroys the Christian religion. And this is, Peter's approach was the antithesis of Pauline Christianity. Rather than urging Yosha to quickly complete his work, he wanted him to postpone. You look at the Seventh-day Adventists. I mean, they were predicting that he was going to return, I think, in the early 19th century. They were obviously wrong. It's no matter whether it's the Seventh-day Adventists or the Jehovah's Witnesses, all of them predicted a day. They all got it wrong, and they want him to hurry so that, you know, he can, you know, prove them right. Whip some holy butt. So, rather than urging Yosha to quickly complete his work, he wanted him to postpone it. So after answering Yosha's question, but who do you say I am, correctly, Yosha said, upon this rock I will build my mikre. Upon, which is all in Hebrew, rock is sur, build is bana, and mikre is the Hebrew word for the seven invitations. It was translated ecclesia. Mikre means to call out, to meet, to greet, and it was ecclesia is the translation of mikre. So, upon this rock, al sur, I will build bana, my mikre. Invitations to be called out and meet. And the ways of this is really. I really didn't know this was here before. But you know what it says? What's the thing he said next? I will build my mikre. And the ways of Shaul will not prevail against. And the ways of Shaul, you know, it reads hell in your English Bible because Hades is the Greek translation of Sheol.
Sheol.
Right. And Sheol and Shaul are the same word in Hebrew. And the ways of Shaul will not prevail against it. Then, what, you know, the next thing that Yosha said, this is profound. He warned his disciples that they should tell no one that he was the Messiah. What do they call themselves? Christians, which is a corruption of the Greek word for the application of drugs that became the replacement for Messiah. They call themselves Christians. Who do they say their Savior is? Jesus Christ. What did he say? Tell no one that I am the Messiah. Tell no one. You know, I've if you listened to this program or read any of the things that I've written in the last 5 years, you'll know that a term that I almost never use is Messiah. I will never use Messiah, and absolutely never use Christ unless it's to be in the Word. Why? He himself said, don't tell anyone that's who I am. Well, that's a pretty good clue. I think he knows what he's talking about. Don't tell anyone that I am the Messiah. And he spoke it in Hebrew, which would have meant, don't tell anyone ever. Not now, not then, not tomorrow. That's pretty powerful. But second, you know how many times Messiah, Mashiach, or which is the Hebrew term, you know how many times the Hebrew term Mashiach, that's what's written in Daniel twice, how many times it appears as a title? Is HaMashiach?
None.
Zero. Yeah, zero.
Zero, yes.
Zero. Not one. Yeah, and the Hebrew word means set apart and prepared to serve. And there were 22 people referred to as Messiah, and Messiah would be the work of Yah. So if he is going to have a title, it would be Messiah, and if and as a as a description, Yosha was set apart and devoted to and prepared to serve, which means that he was Messiah, but as a adjective, not as a title. So there is no basis to call him the Messiah. None. And absolutely no basis to twist Messiah into Christ. None. Not a name, not his title. I had a guy the other day that said, so who is Jesus Christ?
I have nobody.
Nobody.
Your imaginary nobody. Friend?
Yeah, I guess an imaginary friend of Christians. You might as well call him Harvey. You know, no part of that is valid. There is no Jesus. There is no Christ. You're going to need to do a lot better than that if you want me to answer who the Dominion Manifestation of Yahweh actually was, because that name is a mission statement. That name is an identity statement. But they can't figure it out. But that isn't that interesting that it says, and the ways of Shaul will not prevail against it, And then the next thing out of his mouth, he warned his disciples that they should tell no one that he was the Messiah.
Wow. Big stuff.
Oh, my. Have you ever heard a Christian say, anyway, he said, don't tell anyone that I am the Messiah. In fact, in the Greek, it would read, don't tell anyone that I am the Christos, the Christ. And you got a religion named Christianity. And you think your God is Jesus Christ. And you pray to a God named Jesus Christ. And he said, don't tell anyone on that.
How does that leave you?
In serious trouble. Now, both statements are profoundly important, albeit completely misunderstood. But then we discovered that Shimon Kefesh, Peter, tried to delay and even prevent rather than expedite God's return to Jerusalem to affirm and fulfill his plan. The narrative explains. From that time, Yosha began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem to endure many things. From the political leaders, that would be the elders, the religious leaders, that would be the chief priests, and the court government officials, those would be the scribes, and have his body put to death on, obviously, Pesach, and soul return after suffering the separation of matzah, on yeasted bread, on Mukurim, firstborn children, on the third day. And the rock, Shimon, took him aside and began to criticize him, saying, God forbid, upright one, this shall never happen to you. But he turned and said to Shimon, get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me, for you are not setting your mind on God's interests, but man's. That's powerful.
Yes, it is. Wow.
Now, this is what Shaul wrote in Thessalonians 4, 13 through 18. But we do not want you to be uninformed, brethren, about those who are asleep. Now, he didn't quote Yahweh. Yeah, Yahweh has a lot to say about the harvest of Teruah. That's what he's going to write about here. He tells you when it's going to happen. He tells you what day it's going to happen. He tells you how many people relative to the whole of society it's going to happen to. He tells you that it's a harvest. Who is harvested, when they're harvested, why they're harvested. Tells you everything you could ever want to know about Teruah. But does Paul quote anything from the Torah, the prophets, and the Psalms about Teruah? He said, hey, I can tell you when it's going to happen. Damascus is going to fall. It's going to be a heap of twisted ruins. Syria as a country is going to fall. And then these people who have claimed that Allah is God and who are ruthless terrorists are going to flood into Israel as a tsunami right after Israel is thinned at the waist by an affirmation of a treaty. And between those two points is when this is going to happen. You can read it right here in Yeshaya 17 and 18. Is that how he answers?
Too bad.
No. But we do not want you to be uninformed. I don't know who we is, but I guess he and Satan, brethren, about those who are asleep. Isn't that the whole thing of Christianity? We want those who have, the Christians want those who have passed away to be looking down on them, and they want them, you know, want to meet them again in heaven. They want God to have called them home. I mean, if it wasn't for this worry about where am I going and where are those who, my children who died prematurely or my parents or my wife or husband or whoever, if it wasn't for that, religion wouldn't exist. Mm-hmm. It exists for this exact purpose. So he's going right to the heartstrings of religion about those who are asleep. Not dead, asleep here. I tell you something about they're dead. That you may not be anxious and fearful. You know, fear of death. That's the impetus of religion. Grieving as do the rest who have no hope. You know, the hope of an afterlife is the entire purpose of religion. For if we believe that Ha'isu, died and rose again. By the way, God can't die. And he did not rise bodily. Those are facts. Yes. Even so, God will bring with him those who have fallen asleep in Iusun. By the way, those who have fallen asleep in Iusun, what about those? What about Abraham? What about Yishak? What about Jacob? What about Noah? What about Adam and Chawa? What about Shemuel?
Those were Jews who were Torah observant. They were obviously...
What about them? Yeah, it tells us anybody that had a relationship with Yahweh prior to
that's
here,
the old dead God. He no longer matters. Anyone that had a relationship with him doesn't matter.
Yeah, I guess, that from his point of view, the Iusun just fell out of heaven as the living embodiment of Dionysus, and we can forget about the rest of it. For this we say to you by the word of the Lord. Well, that's probably true. The word of the Lord would be the word of Satan. That we who are alive, that would mean that Paul is saying we who are alive and remain until the coming of the Lord. Sorry, Paul, you got that wrong. One false prophecy, and you are a false prophet, shall not precede those who have fallen asleep. For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout, with the command of the archangel. By the way, Halal bin Shakar, Satan, the adversary, was on all likelihood an archangel. Not by angel, one of the leading malach. Probably right up there with Gabriel and with the other leading, because the whole idea of the Malach and the Shabbat, the heavenly host, is it's a command and control regimen. So there would be leaders, and so he was when he's talking about the Lord himself is going to come down with a big shout. It's the last time that Hashatan was going to be cast out of Satan out of heaven. So he is, in fact, going to come down. Now he's talking about Satan here. That's just that Christians think that he's talking about Iusun, whoever that might be. The Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout and the command of an archangel and with the trumpet of God. By the way, God does not have a trumpet. It's the ram's horn, and he has men blow the ram's horn. And the dead in Christo... What did he say? Don't tell anyone that I am the Christo Messiah. And the dead in Christo shall rise first. And then we who are alive and remain shall be caught up together. And he uses raptus, which means violently raptured. Yeah. That's the term when Yosha was talking about, the wolf in sheep's clothing. And he's telling people who are Torahless that call him Lord, that they won't enter heaven. He mocks Paul by using that you're going to be snatched away. Don't allow yourself to be, and he uses the same verb. Well, it's translated the same verb as the rapture. With them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. And we shall always be with the Lord. You're going to always be with Satan. It ain't going to be in the air, however. Therefore, comfort one another with these words. That's Paul.
Not comforting.
Yeah. Didn't bother to quote Yashaya as he talked about the Teruah harvest. Didn't quote the Torah to talk about Teruah. Now, of course, this did not occur in Paul's life. It will not occur, as he stated. Yahweh's schedule is not going to change. He will return for Yisrael and Yahudah on the Day of Reconciliations in year 6000 Yah, sunset in Jerusalem, 6:22 p.m., Monday, October 2nd, 2033, on the Roman Catholic calendar in use today. He will not be coming for Paul, nor for the Christian church. And you may have noticed that Paul preyed on people's fears, consistent with the prophecy, and he used Christ, contrary to Yosha's instructions. He also confused the purpose of Teruah, trumpets, with that of Yom Kippurim, the Day of Reconciliation. Yahweh is not coming for us on Teruah. We're coming to him.
Yes.
Yahweh is coming for Yisrael and Yahudah on Kippurim. Paul got it all twisted.
You know, I would also point out, because the most common argument when you'll use this verse against a Christian is they're going to say, well, he didn't mean himself when he said we. He meant we as in the church. But the point is, the note is, both times he used the word hey, which is the word for we, and it is only used to add an emphasis that the author is included. Because you can pluralize a word in Greek without, if they just use the plural of the word, it could mean we or they. But he used hamis, which, interestingly, hamis is the plural form of a word that most people who speak English know. You know what that word is? Ego. Hamis.
Ego. Oh, yeah.
It's the plural form of ego. Ah.
Yeah, that is correct. Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's the plural. That is correct.
So both times he used it, he specifically used a word that meant he has to be included in this group.
Yeah. I, me, and we, and us, and Greek are all variations of ego. I is ego. We is a variation. Us, me. All variations of ego.
Had he not chosen to use that, you could argue that he was not included in the group he was speaking of. But because he used that word, not once but twice, there is no denying that he included himself in this group.
Yeah. So Christians are aware that he got it wrong.
Oh, yeah.
Just trying to tap dance around. It's okay that he got it wrong because we can twist it. And no problem twisting it. That's what Paul did, so we're following Paul's example. We'll just twist it. Now, what we're going to do, and Kirk, I know you need to go. You're celebrating with Fred and his family. You and Gary are with Noah. Noah.
Yes, sir.
He's got a good name at his.
Trustworthy guy.
At his vineyard. And so we'll bid you adieu, and we're going to say goodnight because we're about ready to embark on what I think is a remarkable collection of quotations.
I love this. Five pages
of quotations of people who are leaders in society, people who have thought this through and have come to...
It just makes you ask, how has this remained so hidden? How did people not know this? Based on how many of these people who are well-known people came to this realization, yet it's a complete mystery to everyone else.
We'll start with Thomas Jefferson and how Thomas Jefferson said, you know, the problem here is Paul. He was the first to corrupt the message. Paul was the great Corypus and the first corrupter of the doctrines of Jesus. That's what he wrote to his closest friend. And we'll read the whole letter because we have a copy of it, the entire letter. That as it relates to this portion of the letter, anyway, when he's writing to...
I can't wait to go over this one.
But we're going to go... That's just where we're going to start. We're going to... There's 5, 6, 7 pages of citations from world-renowned individuals, all of whom came to the same conclusion, that Paul and Yosha, although they don't know the name Yosha, they use Jesus, but that Paul and Jesus said the opposite things, that there is no way to reconcile their testimony. That if one is right, the other is wrong. And if Jesus is wrong, Paul cannot be right. And if Paul is right, there's no way for Paul to be right because he contradicts the one that has to be right for Paul to be right. So the very fact that he contradicts the person he claimed inspired him proves. And so that's what they used as their criterion, 100% of them. And that's a valid criterion. It's not nearly as powerful as Paul contradicting Yahweh, because Paul never once quotes Yosha. His but I, Paul, say is the antithesis of what Yosha said, but he never once quotes it. As for the best way then to prove that Paul lied is he does quote Yahweh a lot. And every time he quotes him, he takes what he said out of context, truncates it, twists it, mistranslates it, misrepresents it, and every time he then promotes a conclusion that's the antithesis of what God actually said. So all you have to do is juxtapose what God said and what Paul claims he said and where Paul wants to go with it versus where Yahweh went with it, and you have absolute irrefutable proof that Paul was the plague of death, the ultimate false prophet, scumbag worse than anyone else who ever lived in all of human history. The single most hated person by God. And he's the founder of the Christian religion and author of half of its New Testament. And there's no one on earth that God hates more. And there's some people that were really bad. I mean, he despises Muhammad. He despises Rabbi Akiva. He despises Maimonides. He despises Hadrian. I mean, there's some people that God really dislikes. The Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Adolf Hitler. But no one comes close. Not even comes even close to Paul. There must be 100 places where Yahweh calls him out by name and warns us about it. No one else by name even gets a mention. So, a lot to ignore if you're a Christian. So Kirk is gone to celebrate Sukkah, and JB, it was a pleasure.
Always
hearing your daughter chirp out.
Yeah, her and Patty are at a family get-together tonight. So.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm glad you joined us. I had never recognized that Paul used that form of ego to describe we who are alive. And obviously, he's talking about himself, and because he wrote the whole thing, it's we. Right. We don't want you to be unaware. So it's the royal we that Paul loved to use, what he wasn't using, but I, Paul, say, not to contradict God. But
and someone tried to argue with me on that one, so I looked it up, and I'm like, all right, let's see. Is their argument valid? And no. Had he not used that, it would be. Because, you know, just the pluralization of it could mean we or they. So if he hadn't put, you know, that word there, it could have been saying those who are alive and not include him. But because he put that there, which literally, if you look at the definition, it says only used to add emphasis.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's no getting around it.
No getting around. And, of course, the Christian apologists, when you proved the point, they just simply migrated to another issue because they couldn't process it.
His exact response was, well, I don't know enough about Greek grammar to argue with you on that. Don't you want to take the time to educate yourself, maybe? You're basing your entire faith, your entire existence on this. Maybe you should verify it.
Right, yeah. I know more about it than you do, and I have rejected it. So what does that tell you? You know, for example, I can tell any Christian, I know vastly more about Paul than you do. I mean, by a million times, and I rejected him. What does that tell you? You know, I know
you should at least
a million times more about the validity of the Christian New Testament than they do, and I rejected it. So ignorance alone prevails when it comes to religious faith?
Exactly. That's why they call it faith.
Yep. So the founder of the Christian religion, the author of half of its New Testament, his name is equivalent to hell.
Fitting.
And he admits to being demon-possessed, and they can't figure it out. And he claims to be
leading the blind
for Yosha, and yet he only attempts to quote him once, and then he took it out of context, and he misquoted him. And he claims to have seen Jesus as a flashing light on the road to Damascus, which is the place that God hates, with a couple of other guys. And he doesn't know if they heard it or if they saw it or not.
They may or may not.
And he was ambulatory. He became blind and lame, which is the opposite of anybody that actually met with Yosha. And what did Yosha say in his Olivet Discourses? He was telling people what to expect. He says there will be someone who comes that claims they have seen the Christ. But don't believe them.
Don't believe them.
When I
the whole world will see me.
Will see me at the same time. Oops. And you don't have a Christian in the world that can put that together and say, well, then Paul lied. Yeah.
boggles the mind.
It boggles the mind how you could have 2.5 billion people that unthinking have chosen to believe what is just a pile of lies. And even worse, you got 1.5 billion Muslims, and the Quran is the worst book ever written. You know, women playing dress-up based upon Muhammad's revelation when Muhammad was a sexual pervert, a rapist, and a pedophile. You say, how could you be that stupid? How could you think your God would want you to go off
and kill innocent people? At least Islam, Muslims have the excuse of, by and large, they live in impoverished, both economically and information-wise, countries where they don't have access to any of the stuff to be able to really prove it wrong, and they're indoctrinated with it and threatened by death with it. So they have at least some excuse.
Yeah, that,
or
I think that used to be true. I think that used to be true. But you know where the highest per capita readership is of Prophet of Doom?
Saudi Arabia?
Iran. Iran. And the top 10 are all
that's helpful.
Islamic countries. Now, those people have, there are more than 7 billion smartphones out there. People now have access to everything and anything. It's the world is wired in. There is no excuse anymore for anybody as part of any religion. I mean, the only thing you have to be able to do is successfully navigate past and around all of the conspiracies and lies, and there are lots of them. So you have to be able to be judgmental
and
be literate, discriminate. Yes, you do. Yeah, but if you're not literate, you're just not going to come to know Yahweh.
Yeah.
Now, I understand there are a lot of programs like these that share his testimony orally, and I understand there's a lot of children of covenant members who know Yahweh because their parents have shared it with them. So are there exceptions where you, but isn't it, it would be uncommon for someone to come to know Yahweh that wasn't literate because Yahweh only represents himself in this world through his word. And as I told the Christian pastor, the ex-Christian pastor who wanted, the short, how am I going to be saved? There are no shortcuts. Yahweh made it hard. He wants it to be hard. If you're not willing to invest the time, he doesn't want you to spend time with him. So there are no shortcuts. You've got to be willing to do the research, but it's the most exhilarating thing you can do.
Oh, yeah. As I mentioned in the chat room, I almost was late to the show because since Patty and Dylan weren't here, I was working on translating and kind of got going. And I looked at the clock and it was like, oh, I got about a minute to get on the phone before the show starts.
Yeah.
And I went to it and I was like, lost track of time.
I did the same thing. I was on Yeshaya 8. And, it's hard. For example, I have a lot of corrections that have been sent to me and additions for the 14th and 15th chapter. It's hard for me to go back to them because I'm having so much fun translating Yeshaya 8 in the 16th chapter. It's great stuff. It's addicting.
Yeah.
Exhilarating.
I don't know what people don't get the ultimate
high. I mean, I don't know what people feel like when they do drugs, so they've never done drugs. But, I guess there's an endorphin rush of something, that dopamines or however the brain gets all excited over these things. I get that kind of a rush as I'm translating.
Yeah.
Because it's not just the translation. It's these are the insights you can glean from it. I'm having a conversation with the creator of the universe, and he's taking the time to share these insights with me, and there are so many of them are goosebump kinds of things. Who needs drugs? I will tell you that the reason that people are so anxious today and so depressed, and they choose to take heroin and fentanyl and cocaine and abuse alcohol and take antidepressant painkillers and anti-anxiety drugs, they don't know Yahweh. Yahweh's fulfilling. There's no depression in him. Now, I will tell you, is it possible to be depressed and know Yahweh? if something were to happen to my wife or either of my two sons, I mean, I'm going to be depressed.
Yeah.
I'm going to be depressed. So is it possible to be depressed? Yeah, absolutely. You know, you suffer loss of a family member? Yeah. And I remember when our good friend Richard passed away, it was a tremendous loss. We loved him.
Yeah.
No, it's a loss. So do we feel sorry? You've got to be able to feel sorrow and pain. Otherwise, well, what's the purpose of love? Yeah, love becomes meaningless if you don't feel a loss. So, no, absolutely. But in terms of depression from any other source, no, it doesn't happen. Frustration from time to time, pain from time to time, but nah. Yeah, it was exhilarating. Yeah, it was exhilarating. Yeah, it was absolutely exhilarating. So we'll have fun as we go through these statements. We'll begin on what is the 33rd chapter or 33rd page of 60, and Observations chapter 14. So we're only about halfway through Observations 14, and it's the end of it that actually drew us to this, because Yahweh was kind enough to talk about us. And it's astounding that flawed implements as we are, that he would call us out and say, this was going to happen at this time, and I'm going to lift this up as a banner, and talking specifically about what we have done together. So it's a marvelous bit of a pat on the back from the creator of the universe. So that's why we turn to it, and we're halfway through that chapter.
Yeah.
All right, my friend. We will talk next week. Happy Sukkah.
Have a good Sukkah.
Good night. Okay, good night.